You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hi, I'm Allie Kane. Welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building and growing consumer brands. When we launched a line of fresh sauces for grocery stores, I knew we were jumping into something crazy. Haven's Kitchen is a cooking school, cafe, and event space. A product that people buy in grocery stores is an entirely new business, and I had a lot to learn. So in my efforts to get myself educated, I started meeting everyone I know and respect who could advise me on production and distribution, sales and legal, PR, and social media. And then I started having those conversations here as a podcast, so that other entrepreneurs can learn from them as well. This is the story of Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand, because we're all in the sauce. Today, for my 20th episode, I'm speaking with Pat Jamay, a bit of a legend in the world of marketing. After starting his career at Honest Tea, Pat took on field marketing at Sir Kensington's, eventually becoming VP of marketing at the company. One of the nicest guys I know, and honestly someone who can sell anything to anyone. I'm super excited to have Pat here today. Hi, Pat.
Hey, how's it going, Allie?
Good. So first off, before we get into your whole life story and we dive deep into your deepest, darkest wishes, can you define marketing and sort of define out field marketing a little bit? Because I didn't know what field marketing was until I got into this whole CPG world. And I think of marketing as sort of this bigger thing, but you do both. So can you kind of give me an overview of them both?
Sure. I mean, so marketing, you know, can play a bunch of different roles depending on what industry you're in, what category you're in. The role it plays in your company it's definitely lives on a spectrum in my mind. But at its simplest, I think marketing is really finding a way to connect with your consumers and your customers. And create awareness and trial and just create growth and awareness for your company. So a lot of times that means working with retailers to expand your presence. It means finding the consumers that are looking for the problem you're solving and making them aware that there's a solution. So it's really connecting with your customers and your consumers.
And how, I mean, that's interesting, right? Because I also didn't know the difference between a customer and a consumer before I got into the grocery world. So break that down a little bit, because I think people just think people who buy the product, but they're not just people who buy the product.
Right. So most food companies that are in your pantry, that are in your fridge, that you love and know, you're not buying directly from them. You know, nowadays with the rise of direct to consumer and e-com, it's happening a lot more. But traditionally, when you walk into a supermarket, you're buying something from a grocery store who's purchased it from a distributor who's purchased it from us.
Right.
So oftentimes when you think about it, there are kind of two layers of disconnection between a brand and the end consumer. So for us, a distributor would be our customer.
Right.
Whereas two layers down, our actual consumer, the person who's actually using the product, is the person buying it at the store. So.
And in my case, like I know, you know, we were just talking about this, like, and I've talked about it before on the show, you know, for a refrigerated sauce that's vegan, we're being bought primarily by dairy buyers at grocery stores. So people who don't know what chimichurri is or romesco is, and it's certainly not dairy. And so trying to speak to them and explain to them what the product is a very different message than, hey, home cook, you know, you don't have time, put the sauce on your food. Like two totally different messages.
Right.
And then field marketing, give me a little bit of an overview of that.
So field marketing, and like I'll take that example you just gave where, you know, it does take a little more education, a little bit more understanding from a grocery team of what the product is and why it should be in a certain set. So when you have a field marketing is really connecting with customers and consumers in person through an experience in the field, basically in the real world.
And that's, you know, like demos.
That could be anything from demos, events. You know, field marketing also can play a bunch of different roles within the company, depending on what industry category is, the way the rest of the organization is built. You know, sometimes you see organizations with leaner sales teams mm-hmm. where field marketing kind of plays a role with merchandising and sales development more so. When you see an organization that has a fully built out sales team, then oftentimes field marketing is more just consumer focused, end consumer focused, acquiring them, sampling to them,
right.
And just reaching them in other ways. So field marketing can run a whole spectrum of what it can mean for your company. You know, and it's important to know that going in is
right.
to not just say, okay, field marketing, demos and events and guerrilla sampling.
Right.
Because, you know, field marketing at its best, it's got to be prescriptive and diagnostic for what your brand needs and for what your kind of sales strategies are and your strategies on the actual brand side of how you want to show up to your consumer. So field marketing oftentimes can be the in-between between sales and marketing
right.
and then how you show up to a customer.
Right. It's interesting because I think, you know, until the last several months, I didn't even know that I needed that. I thought you had operations and they made the product and sales sold the product and tidy. Right. But actually there's this third leg, you know, I think, and it's a really valuable third leg, especially when you have a product that needs a little bit more, like we were talking about some products, you know, you just know they're a better for you version than something that's already there that you've been accustomed to. But a product like mine needs a lot more sort of education and a lot more people out there kind of teaching people what it is, consumers and customers.
Right. And field marketing, whether it's a consumer or the grocery manager, offers a great way to just through human contact, through an interaction, and building a relationship to get more mindshare for your brand. When you think yeah. about consumers and even grocery managers, they're just inundated with like hundreds yeah. and thousands of
they
brands
see a lot
that
of stuff.
put me on your shelf, give me a display. And consumers mm-hmm. are just being marketed to every way they turn.
Yep.
So whenever you can use film marketing to kind of break through the clutter and get more mind share and just get noticed and tried, that's a huge win.
Awesome. Okay, now going back to you as a young boy, because I love these things because everyone always sort of has. No one, you didn't study field marketing in fourth grade.
Oh,
you
no.
probably didn't go to high school thinking you were going to be in field marketing in your life. But yet there was probably something about you even from a young age. I know you come from a hospitality background. So I know you're a people person family. But as like a fourth grader, what did you think you wanted to be?
Wow, as a fourth grader, I think at the time, as a fourth grader, I actually wanted to be the general manager of the New York Yankees.
Okay.
That was kind of my big dream.
I love everyone's, I mean, Lauren from Excel Foods, who's now like an investor, yeah. did you happen to hear what she wanted to be a Nick City dancer, also an orthopedic surgeon, so
wow.
she could be on the floor dancing, but also if someone got injured, tend to them.
There
we go. And just the fact that that's like what she wanted to be in fourth grade is amazing. And so you wanted to be the GM of
the New York Yankees.
The Yankees. Yes. Like George Costanza.
Costanza, exactly.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Big Seinfeld
All right.
fan.
And is that because you were a sports guy?
You know, I was always a huge fan of the Yankees, diehard. We watch almost every game.
Right.
Just the whole notion of putting a team together.
Yeah. Well, that's what makes sense. Right.
Which is funny now because that's what I do for work. But now mm-hmm. putting teams together, finding talent that complements each other, you know, taking into account culture amongst other things. It's not just about the stats on paper.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the intangibles and the kind of in between the stat lines. So just that whole notion of like every season trying to put together.
You are basically building the Yankees every time you build a team.
Well, hopefully that's the goal.
And so where was your first, you went to school. Did you have a twin?
I have a twin brother,
and
yes.
did you guys go to school together?
We went to grammar school and high school together.
Okay.
But always kind of, you know, we weren't one of these sets of twins that did everything together and had the exact same friends. We were very mindful of kind of having our own lives.
Right.
But yeah, we went, you know, shared a room together, went to school together up until we were about 18, and
right.
then we split ways for college, which
was
great. It was definitely good. You know, tough to be away from your twin brother, but a great
right.
way to kind of grow and evolve on your own as an individual.
I tend to really like people that are twins. I've just noticed that. Like, a bunch of my friends over the course of my life have been twins. Interesting. Just a side note, neither here nor there. So what did you study in college? Did you study marketing?
No, I did not. I studied accounting.
Oh my gosh,
yes.
Really?
Yeah, going
but
into college,
like,
I...
You're so not... You have like this big personality
yeah.
and you, like, you're so gregarious. No offense to accountants out there, but I don't see you accounting.
Well, maybe I was trying to disrupt the accounting world, but okay. No, but seriously, I didn't have a clear idea. I think once I got to around college, I realized I wasn't going to be GM of the Yankees.
Right.
And I started, I was always really good in math growing up. So I figured, let me head in that direction and I'll figure it out along the way. And in between my junior and senior year, I got an internship at Honest Tea. Field marketing and field sales.
Right. So you applied for that?
I applied for that, yes.
And did you know what you were applying for?
Not really. I just remember reading the job description and it's saying that this was a field position that you'd be out and about every day. Right. And I was like, wow, that'd be awesome. I just getting paid to kind of run around the city and just be outside all summer. I was like, this is great. I didn't, at that point, 3 years into an accounting degree, I started getting a little claustrophobic at the thought of just sitting in a cubicle for like 30 years.
And right.
Oh, so I started, I was kind of like looking for something. And my twin brother, Nick, actually sent me the internship because it was posted at the Georgetown Career Center. And it worked out. And I got the internship and that summer was insane. It was like, wait, this is work? People get paid for this?
So what were you doing? I mean, as an intern, you were running around from store to store and...
Yeah, so we were primarily, this was Honest Tea back in 2006. Mm-hmm. And they had just launched with a big distributor called Big Geyser. They're one of the biggest and well-known DSD distributors. They built Vitamin Water and Smart Water. And we had just launched with them a few years ago, and they were a big focus of ours. So one of my priorities was to be able to, was to go in there at like 6 a.m. every day.
Right.
Because distributor world, their trucks are going out the door at 6:30.
Yep.
And to just kind of create buzz and to get, Big Geyser is an owner-operated distributor. Right. So all these guys own their routes. They're not just like employees of the distributor. They own their routes, and they have a lot of autonomy. And this is one of the first big lessons I learned in field marketing is that relationships are paramount if you're trying to get things done. If you're trying to disrupt and you're trying to bend the rules and get things done that aren't...
Like getting second and tertiary facings.
Exactly. No, I mean, the difference between...
I'll explain that later, Matt.
The difference between one of these route owners selling the hell out of your product and not even pretending like you exist was if they liked you.
Yeah.
And if you spent the day with them and you went on a route ride and they loved you... All of a sudden, they're calling you the rest of the week saying, hey, I got this new account. Hey, I'm pushing. And all of a sudden, they're an extension of you, and they're pushing it for you.
So you just basically you hit the ground running. Like, you got to Honest Tea, and you figured out this special sauce, like, pretty much the minute that you got there. And it happened to align perfectly with your naturally winning personality.
Right. And so, my first week on the job, they put me with this, like, really, like, rough around the edges, hard-nosed distributor guy who was notorious for not wanting to ride with anybody.
Right.
He would ditch people mid-ride.
Oh, my God.
He's just a horror story. And for some reason, we just hit it off first thing in the morning. And this was, like, a very untapped source of cases for Honest Tea at the time. It was the Washington Heights area, believe it or not. Like the hospital and the schools up there. It's a great place for Honest Tea. So we ended up like tripling sales in just 3 weeks there. And everybody was like, what's going on? And it was just relationship based, I would take them out for a nice lunch. I'd hang a carrot in front of
them.
But
how did you know intuitively how to do that? I mean, I know you got your mom, your parents had a restaurant.
Yes.
Yes. So was it in your bones maybe to just think of taking someone out for a meal? I mean, a college kid wouldn't normally think of doing that or would be just too nervous sitting in the truck. Like, what happened?
Well, it's funny that, early on when you start going out with these guys, you realize that it really is all, there's so much human discretion. Like, if they don't like you, they're not going to sell you. So I think just coming from a hospitality background, you realize how much connecting with people and almost having kind of a service-oriented approach to, like, I'm here to support you, I'm here to help you, really goes a long way. And I think he felt that early on. And, and we connected over a couple of other, like, really small, funny things right off the bat. And really all comes down to human discretion a lot of times. Yeah. I mean, human discretion is it's a bigger thing than most people give it credit for.
You know what's interesting is that I've had a few, like, supply chain and operations people on, and they've said the exact same thing. And that's not an area of this whole, process that you would think would be as human-oriented. Right. You're making the widget, you're selling the widget, right? Except that the widget might not get to where it needs to get to unless you're friendly with the guy who's driving the truck. And the only way you get to be friendly with the guy who's driving the truck is if you ask him questions about his life and know him, and he genuinely thinks that you're human on the other end of the phone that he wants to help.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's a very relationship. And that's why at the end of the day, it's so much fun, I think, because we're all making products, but it's really about building connections.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, I always used to say this at Sir Kensington, so no matter what you think about in a company, the product, the website, and any kind of distributor for any or any, everything has a human at its genesis or a human behind it. Mm-hmm. So there is, at the end of the day, human discretion behind all of it.
Right.
So even something as simple as, I remember I used to be on the road all the time with Honesty, and the expense policies were very, very light. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sometimes finding a good hotel was tough. And, you know, believe it or not, you think that a hotel has a standard rate. If you just walk up to the counter and you start befriending them and you're like, hey, what's the friends and family, right? Like,
right.
Everybody, they all have discretion. All of a sudden, right. The rate got $20 lower.
You also, you just have a way. Like, you really do. It's pretty cool. You kind of have a little gift. Anyway.
Thank you.
So after, yeah, you're welcome. So Honesty, I mean, we could talk about that. That was 5 years.
That was eight years of my life, yeah.
So, I mean, there were a lot of things you learned, but you climbed that ladder and you kind of built the ladder and then climbed up it, it sounds like.
Yeah, it was an interesting eight-year run. Like, when I got there, I was the 12th person there, and mm-hmm. to just see the kind of growth and then the interest from Coca-Cola. The acquisition happened about fourth or fifth year I was there. Wow. So I also got to see 3 years post-Coke acquisition, which was...
Right.
I learned so much from it. It was so, so awesome to see the other side of the coin and
yeah.
how these large corporations operate from internally.
What do you think, if you had to, would be like the biggest sort of lesson or learning experience or the biggest sort of thing you took from the time at Honest?
You know, obviously what I mentioned before about human discretion and, mm-hmm. and never taking that for granted. And the other thing for me is really, you know, not always, but sometimes it's better to beg for forgiveness than ask for permission.
Yeah.
And you can go a long way doing that, especially when you're, you know, when you're a small company that's just been acquired by a big company, and, you know, depending on that company, they have different ways of handling, you know, new venture brands in their house. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've just got to be willing to be the pirate in their ocean, because if you just go by, can I do this? No. Can I do this? No.
Right.
And if you just keep asking for permission, you're going to get stonewalled a lot of the times.
Yep.
Because a lot of times when you're dealing with Coca-Cola legal, it's like they're just looking to CYA.
Right, exactly.
You know, they're just going to defer to no, even though there could be a creative way to do it. And,
right.
So that was interesting. And even, you know, fast forwarding to Sir Kensington's, where we eventually got acquired by Unilever, it was really interesting to see the differences between Coke and Unilever and how they handled acquiring a brand and their whole approach was to the brand. It was pretty stark contrast there.
Did you, when you went to Sir Kensington's, so you left Honest and you were ready for something new, presumably, and you wanted to grow something again a little bit?
Yeah, I left Honest, got to the point where, you know, I really wanted to jump headfirst into something again and, you know, just go all out for one brand. And, you know, mm-hmm. for me, it had to be a brand that I was a consumer of. And,
right.
you know, it really doesn't matter if some energy drink, Rockstar or Monster were to come to me and offer me, like, it really wouldn't matter how much they'd offer me because I wouldn't. You know, it's tough being in field marketing and trying to tell people to drink something that you wouldn't drink or consume. It's hypocritical.
Totally.
At its, you know.
And so you, I mean, I know you, seriously, it's sort of legendary. Like you, I mean, the folklore has it, basically, that the plan was let's get to be sort of like the number one ketchup at Whole Foods. Yep. And that you basically did that. That's what the rumor is, that you sort of like, just built the heck out of it and sampled the heck out of it and made friends with every single Whole Foods buyer and slept there and helped them unpack and gave them your firstborn children. And so tell me, I'm sure there's like, that's a little exaggerated.
Yeah,
maybe,
there's a lot to that story. But yeah, I mean, we identified the natural channel as being like, you know, we need to win in the natural channel and succeed to start winning in conventional and to really get the brand to the next level. Mm-hmm. And obviously there, we could talk about Whole Foods for hours on its own and kind of what they used to be and what that transition that's been happening over the last few years, mm-hmm. even way before Amazon came into the picture, this whole notion of centralization. But we identified the natural channel with Whole Foods being the lead is like, we need to win here. We need mm-hmm. to do whatever it takes to win here. Almost kind of like pushing the snowball to the top of the hill to then get it over and start the avalanche. And so we decided, and when I say we, it was me, Mark Scott, the whole senior management team. We decided mm-hmm. to just overinvest in Whole Foods,
right?
And we knew that if we would win in Whole Foods and we were acquiring all those consumers there and gaining shelf space and gaining share, that would create so much momentum, not only within natural but way past natural. So we built a field marketing team in 8 markets around the country, all in-house. You know, so all W-2 full-time salaried employees. And you know, the important thing when you're building an internal field marketing team, in my opinion, especially early on, is that you can't just look for experience and skills. It's got to be culture fit and, right. and kind of personality and fit.
Yeah.
And so I wouldn't tell you to hire someone who's a culture fit but can't capability-wise do the job.
Right.
But you've got to value the culture fit just as much as the experience and the skills. And, you know, sometimes I'd rather find someone who's a great culture fit, who has the capability and the smarts,
right.
but might not be experienced. It might just need to be trained.
Yeah. I mean, it's not something that a lot of people are. And it's also something, I mean, I'm 46. I'm not going to be a good hire for that job, right? You're running around. You're like on all the time. You're kind of hustling, right? So not to say that it's that someone my age couldn't do it, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's unlikely that there are a lot of people with a lot of experience doing it who really want to be good, you know, doing it, who are good at it. Like it's sort of
right.
A
yeah,
new,
it is. I mean, field excited. Marketing for a company like that does involve a lot of erratic work. So like weekends, holidays, a lot of peak times for consumers mm-hmm. are what are typically off peak for regular office people are mm-hmm. peak times for field marketing. It's
right.
when people are out, you want to hit them. So yeah, I mean, typically it is a pretty grueling job, and you know, I have found for the most part, people kind of in the first half of their career, you'll see,
right.
Yes. be more excited and use field marketing as a stepping stone to get right. into brand marketing, to get into sales.
Right.
But yeah, when we built this team at Sir Kensington's, it was 8 really passionate field managers that we went out of our way to make sure that the thought of standing in Whole Foods for 3-4 hours to them was like, cool.
Yeah.
And they would get giddy about it. Like, wait, I get to yeah. see behind the curtain at Whole Foods.
Yeah.
I get to go in the back. Like when you find people who are excited by that, it's like, all right, I can teach you how to sample. As long as you've got the personality and the work ethic,
right.
you can teach everything else. You can't teach that. So we built this team. We muscled it up over 3 years, going from 400 demos a year to 3,000 to 6,000.
6,000 demos a year?
6,000 demos a year, yeah. You know, holy in the category God. That we were in, a condiment, which is center right. of store, pretty slow velocity.
Yep.
It's not like chips or drinks where you're right. buying one or two a day. The demos really went a long way to just start creating some like aggressive inertia and momentum
right.
with our sales and velocities. And, you know, while we were in the stores, the focus was like, yeah, let's sample. Let's reach as many consumers as possible and make them aware of it, get them to try it for the first time, and get them to buy it for the first
right.
time. That was kind of the goal. Like, let's get them through that funnel.
Right.
But on the other side, it was also like, let's connect with these grocery managers
right.
and let's go out of our way to like befriend them and, you know, as we say at Sir Kensington's, homie it out with them.
Right.
We call it the homie factor. It was just a way to kind of put some text to the approach of going in
right.
store and trying to get more mindshare from these guys. So that would include just coming in at 7 a.m. with like coffee and donuts and
yep.
not asking for anything.
Right.
Just there to build a relationship.
Yep.
You know, we were constantly at these overnight resets, whether our category is being reset or not.
Oh my gosh.
You know, when you want to be able to ask something of a grocery manager, you know, you better support them as well. So we always viewed it as like a partnership. We didn't want to be vendors. We wanted to be like partners and homies.
Right.
So we went out of our way to just demo a lot, really create these relationships. You know, at the time things were a little bit more Wild West in Whole
yes,
Foods. So
you could do that. You could
we were
sleep
able
over
to,
in Whole
oh
Foods,
yeah.
yeah.
And so we were able to leverage all these demos and all these relationships
right.
for a lot of displays.
Yeah. That's
I mean,
so cool.
My team and I, you know, I didn't sell a single one of those displays and it was all my team and they did such a good job.
That's amazing.
We ended up getting something like 500 incremental displays, on the perimeter of the store. And
wow.
that year our sales just exploded and we went global at Whole Foods. And
right.
before you know it, we were in a position where we were able to pull back off Whole Foods and start applying the field marketing team to conventional and club and other channels, and even getting out of store a little bit more.
Right.
So yeah, so it was, we just kind of got that snowball to the top of the hill with Whole Foods. If you look at a 1-year P&L, how much we invested in Whole Foods versus
right.
how much we made, like we lost money.
Yeah.
But it was
a
deliberate
trade
plan.
Anyway. I feel
yeah.
like that's just how marketing is.
Right.
You know?
And especially for an account like Whole Foods that is really it's such a contagious account. Like
right.
success there breeds success outside of it. And
yes.
a lot of people look to Whole Foods. So
yeah.
for us, we saw it as a deliberate overinvestment.
Yep.
And it worked out.
No, it's amazing. And now you're at Good Culture.
Now I'm at Good Culture, yes.
So tell us about the cottage cheese changing cottage cheese.
So Good Culture is a premium dairy brand that started in cottage cheese and has
mm-hmm.
been kind of lighting up that category for the past 3 years. And now we've kind of ventured into widening our portfolio into just overall dairy.
Oh, cool.
So we just launched a sour cream.
Awesome.
And we've got some really cool innovation in the works that probably a few weeks away from being able to speak about, but
right.
another 2 to 3 categories that are just going to kind of further widen our brand as a better
Amazing.
Dairy company.
Well, they're lucky to have you, and I'm psyched for all of you. We're going to take a little break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk nitty-gritty on how founders should really think about field marketing, build their teams, and what the objectives should be.
Awesome.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com. Did you find?
Hi, I'm back with Pat Jamay, a marketer extraordinaire. One of the reasons I'm so happy you're here is because I don't think most founders understand the disconnect between getting their products on the shelf and getting them off the shelf. So, you know, when I was first starting to sell the sauces, I was definitely kind of ringing the bell the minute that someone took them, you know, Whole Foods wanted to put in a PO, I rang the bell. Fresh Direct wanted to put in a PO, I rang the bell. You don't realize that you don't really ring the bell until, like, they actually go off the shelf, right? So I think a lot of people sort of think, like, I'm going to open doors, and I'm going to get buyers to like me. But there's something that then has to happen once you're in the door, right? Once you're on the shelf. And that's where I think that the field marketing really comes into play, yeah. Right? So if you were going to just sort of like have field marketing 101 and you had a bunch of founders sitting in front of you, which you could probably do and make a lot of money doing, what would be sort of, how would you sort of talk about it? How would you want a founder to think about it, to budget for it? What would be the main objective of it?
Yeah. So, I mean, right off the bat, I think you touched on it right there. It's when you think about starting a business and, yeah, you got the PO. Okay, yeah, I can make it. I can get it to them and I can be profitable. Like, you know, I can make margin on it. Cool. Mm-hmm. That's only half of the story. So right. We always think of things in terms of push and pull. Mm-hmm. And what you're talking about is the push. You're pushing product into the store, into the back door, onto the shelves. And then the most important piece after that is obviously making it pull off the shelf and go out the mm-hmm. front door of the store. And that's where the magic happens. When you have a good push and pull coming in and out of the store. And when you think about pull, obviously there's some of those higher altitude levers that you can pull to create pull, like having great packaging.
Right.
Is a great way to just create organic pull. But sometimes when you're in a new store and your awareness is low, you've got to go in and pull some of those manual levers, which is where field marketing kind of comes in. So when you're thinking about field marketing, you know, I kind of mentioned it before, but for me, it's got to be prescriptive. Mm-hmm. It can't just be, okay, we want to do field marketing. What's the standard? What's the standard program?
Right. Stand at a table and like put a little cup of sauce in front of people and be like, buy this.
Right. Or like, let's go sponsor a bunch of big events. And,
right.
You know, if your distribution isn't at a certain point, I've never found it to be, or you have like a direct to consumer business, that's a different situation. But if your distribution isn't big enough, it doesn't make sense to spend a lot of money outside of the store.
Right.
I've always found early on, you've got to spend money in the store. So mm-hmm. field marketing, as I see it, is really a support department. It should not be a standalone department. It's a department, and I've seen it live in sales. I've seen it live in marketing.
Right.
I've seen it live in sales and then go to marketing
as
the company grows.
Yeah, for me, I don't have marketing, so it lives in sales for
right.
me.
Right. And that's totally fine, because field marketing should be connected at the hip with sales.
Right.
I mean, field marketing should never be a standalone department. It should always be strategically. A field marketing strategy should derive from a sales strategy and a brand strategy. Mm-hmm. So on one side, the sales strategy is, okay, where are we trying to pull levers? Where are we trying to create some early success and velocity? You know, and that's really important on the sales side.
Yeah. And I have a feeling I know your answer to this, but there are external teams. There yes. are merchandising teams and demo teams, and there are field marketing teams for hire out there. I have a feeling I know what you're going to say, but thoughts for founders on money well spent, internal versus external, and how to hire. Like, how would you build your team if you were starting on day one? You have someone doing sales, let's say. You have someone dealing with supply chain and operations. Would you hire a field marketing person? Like, how would you think about it? Or would you outsource?
You know, it really all depends. There's so many variables in terms of what is the talent on that current team look like? What's your budget? You know, again,
no one has any money.
Okay. Nobody has any money,
but yeah, I mean, zero.
Early on with field marketing, I mean, I love for me, I'm a big proponent of having it in-house as opposed to outsourcing it. And listen, there's no, you know, some people want to run a company a little bit leaner and they want to outsource everything, and that's totally fine. But when you're in a category like natural foods and something that really takes a lot of education and really, you know, you're really fishing in certain waters, you really have to be targeted. Mm-hmm. I just find hiring internal teams gives you so much, allows you to be so much more nimble. If you're an organization that's in early stage growth and you expect to continue growing, hiring people that are passionate about your brand that can grow with your brand is so valuable.
Yeah.
So for me, you know, internal field marketing, if you think about field marketing of, you know, that it's got to be profitable with each day and each demo, and it's got to pay for itself in the 1 month view and the 1 year view, it's going to be kind of tough, right?
No chance.
I mean, obviously there's scenarios and ways where stars can align where it can't do that. But in my mind, that's the wrong thinking for it.
Right.
You know, field marketing is really to create advocates, to create loyal consumers, to find them, to drive trial. So when you're doing that, you want to think about, you know, think about this. You're at a demo and you sample to 200 people. Mm-hmm. And I might have to sell 200 units to break even on that demo.
Right.
Right? Probably unlikely, unless it's just like super nuts.
Right.
But if I sell 50 jars in a demo, right? And the hope is that 50 people bought it for the first time and that, you know, round numbers here, let's say half of them liked it and they're going to come back and buy it.
Yep.
That's 25 other jars. And let's say out of those 25 people, half of those are going to start buying it every week.
Right.
And so now those 12 people times 12 months, you know, times whatever, how many weeks are left in the year.
Right.
So you more, I mean, almost like kind of direct to consumer, you want to think about it in terms of like the annual value of a customer. And not only the annual value of them, and this is where it's tough because you get a lot of these founders that are just data nerds and they want to see the data, they want to see the numbers and the ROI. But once they've sampled it and I've sold them their first one, you lose the ability to track that consumer's journey.
Sure.
And how much have they returned to you? So for me, you know, if you've got a really high quality product that has a lot of points of difference in its category, and you want to go find like your lowest hanging fruit, like your most likely to be loyal consumers, I think field marketing is one of the most targeted and effective ways to do it.
And specifically demos.
Where, like I said earlier on, like the more limited your distribution is and the less places that people can buy it, the more you should focus on making the places where they can buy it succeed and turn.
Yes.
Because, you know, velocity breeds velocity and success. If it starts working there, your distributor is going to take notice. Other accounts are going to take notice, and it starts to snowball.
So I have a pretty like specific question, right? So at Whole Foods, we sell anywhere from, you know, let's say our best weeks, we sell over 40 units a week. And for a sauce, that's pretty good. Yeah. Over three SKUs. So let's say it's, you know, it's a case and a half per unit. And per SKU. And at the other stores that aren't Whole Foods, we do not sell that much. We're always a little bit confused if we should double down on the stores that are doing well for us, or if we should try to bring those other stores kind of up. And how would you think about, like, do you have sort of like a, you do your top five, you do your bottom five, and you let your middle 25 sit? Or like, do you have a way to think about that? Or
I mean, so resources and budget aside, right? Putting that aside, I mean, just in general, talking in general terms, I've always found it to, you know, you want to fish where the fish are.
So
if you've got 30 Whole Foods in a region, and you know, you can realistically, you know, you're looking at the top 10 of those Whole Foods, those top 10 Whole Foods in your region, you're probably gonna have more, the ability to, they're gonna have more foot traffic. They're just gonna be selling more. You're gonna have more of an opportunity to create like a significant like an uptick in sales and velocities right off the bat.
Right.
And that's just gonna, like, when you think about, if you're fishing, right? I mean, you wanna go where there's as many fish as possible, right? And so eventually there comes a point where, like, you know, the whole notion of squeaky wheel gets the grease, but it shouldn't be a wheel that has no chance of ever not squeaking, if you will. So oftentimes I've always found success in like really focusing on like the lowest hanging fruit and let's say it's the top third of stores.
Yep.
And once you've seen like some significant gains in those, we would start to kind of cycle in other stores from the middle third.
Right.
And we would closely watch the first set of stores that we backed off of to see, like, okay, is there an increased baseline?
Yep.
No, even if they slip, it's natural.
Right.
But as long as the baseline is significantly higher than it was before, then that's sustainable organic growth.
Yep.
And now if we can get all the baselines up, I mean, that's really when you think about how do you measure field marketing and the efficacy of a big demo program. Because you lose the ability to track people's like annual or lifetime value.
Right.
I mean, I always like to think about this concept of like the overall rising tide of sales.
Yep.
And like, you know, there's certain metrics you can look at to really see, okay, is this organic growth?
Yeah.
You know, one really good metric is same SKU year over year sales.
Right.
So that means
we have that this week.
Right.
This is our first week of having a year over year.
Nice.
It's our first full year.
So now you'll be able to comp them and see how it's going. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. That's sometimes when you see growth and you're like, oh, look, we did demos, things are growing. But if it's from like new distribution or new SKUs like that, it's definitely something that you want to take into account. And when you look at same SKU year over year, you can really tell, okay, these have been in here for a year and we've been sampling them. Have the people that are trying them picked them up regularly?
Right.
Are they starting to really buy into it? And that's usually a really good measure.
Right. What do you think? I mean, for people, because most people that are listening to this, they're not doing much more than demos. Like this is the sort of the size. How much should demos cost and what makes a good demo? And I mean, okay, yes, we can't put an exact value to if a demo has been successful because we can't track that customer necessarily going forward. But there are probably some guidelines.
Right.
What are the big no-nos in a demo? And what are the big sort of like, you should definitely try to achieve this?
Well, so obviously the most important thing with any plan, any business, anything is the people, right? So the people that you're hiring for your demos, I can have the best field marketing team. I can have the best product. But if I have a really bad brand ambassador standing behind the table, like none of that really matters because that's the touch. That's where the tire touches the road with consumers with your sampling is the sampler. So,
and how did you find people as good as you? Like, what was it in them? Was it just like you just met them and you just got a good vibe or?
Well, you know, one thing, it's the waters you're fishing in, right? So where you, and I keep using fishing analogies.
No,
I'm not a big fisher,
baseball
but
and fishing. Yeah.
But so it's where are you looking for them? Where are you recruiting? You know, most people just like throw ads up on Craigslist and you can find some gold there every once in a while, but you usually have to sift through a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of other stuff. So, I mean, at Sir Kensington's, it was all about bringing integrity and charm to ordinary and overlooked food. We were very much in the world of food, from food service operators, restaurants, to grocery stores.
Mm-hmm.
And condiments, as you know, being an ingredient that rarely ever stand on their own.
Right.
And they have to go with something. So we were, saw ourselves right in the middle of this whole food world. So for us, we were like, we need to find people that are passionate about cooking, passionate about food, and just passionate about the natural foods industry in general.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if you can find a sampler who's like, you're going to pay me to stand in a Whole Foods and talk to you 4 hours? Sure, sign me up.
Right.
Like, you want people who are just going to just organically be motivated. And you know, you've all seen them, you've all walked up to these samplers in certain stores and they don't even look up.
No.
They're just like passing you something. They're like regurgitating
one
line.
I'm a person who ends up buying that thing because I feel bad for like the person because they're not making any sales, and I also feel bad for the company that hired that person. So I'm the winner who has like the random tea in my pantry, or like I am the worst because I buy everything that anyone's sampling just out of guilt.
Oh,
I don't
even
have to like it. Usually I don't. And actually when I don't like it, that's when I buy it.
Do when you come across a good sampler?
there haven't been that many. There was a great sampler from, the North Carolina peanut butter company, Big Spoon Roasters.
Big Spoon.
She was great.
Thanks.
I don't know where she is now, but if you're listening, Big Spoon,
hit us up.
So going back to what are the sort of big no-nos and the big yes-yeses?
Well, yeah. So when you think about a demo, first off is people is the most important part of it. You asked what an average demo should cost.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I mean, you always want to try and make them as efficient as possible while optimizing how you're going to look, how much product you're actually going to be able to sample. So for me, in my past, I've always seen it between $100 and $150.
Right.
That's not including all the overhead of having like salaries and in-house. It's just the actual cost of a demo with the part-time sampler.
And so you're saying don't expect to sell $150 worth of product. And if you don't, that's okay. It doesn't make it necessarily.
I mean, I think you can expect to sell $150 worth of product through Whole Foods Register. But you're as a company, you're not going to make $150 profit on that.
That's a lot. I mean, I don't think we've sold. I mean, what's 20 times 8? 160. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that's about our average, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But then when you, if you really drill down and you think, okay, what's my average margin and what, then you can really drill down and you'll see it's almost not going to be profitable.
Right. Yes.
I've heard a couple of like exceptions. I know the Bonza guys,
they crush it.
They go pretty nuts. Especially when one of those founders gets behind the table, they'll sell like 200 or 300 boxes.
Yeah.
And that's a profitable demo, but that's not a demo that you can do 6,000 times around the country.
Right. No.
But that should, you know, that you should always strive for that and always try and get better. But at the end of the day, if you're in the mindset of like, I'm trying to find people that are going to be like frequent users and I want to find them and get my product in their hands and get them to taste it. When you have a good product, I mean, the conversion after that, you've almost got to like trust it, you know? It's like it's like Wayne's World. If you book them, they will come.
Yes.
If you sample them, they will purchase eventually. Yes.
So other than Bonza, are there other companies that you think are doing a really good job at it that you've seen?
Well, Sir Kensington's aside. I think, you know, I'm just getting into it. I've been only here for 1 week, but Good Culture has a pretty significant sampling program. So I'm excited to get in there and kind of get my hands dirty with it. But
you're gonna have fun.
They've been doing a great job. Their sales numbers are really impressive.
And for the no-nos, don't have someone who's on their phone. Don't have someone who doesn't like the product.
Yes. Well, I'd say one no-no is, I mean, the biggest no-no you can do is not connecting the demo to sales and to the sales team, because the worst thing you could have is you're paying a sampler to go to a store and they get there and there's like 5 units on the shelf. That's like murder for it. I mean, there's like no point in showing up at that point.
Yeah.
So really making sure, I mean, the whole point of the demo, the whole point of field marketing in general is to create incrementality. Now, especially with the demo, you're trying to create incremental sales, you're trying to get incremental customers. And if the product's just not on the shelf, then you just, no matter how good, you just have no shot.
That was actually a challenge for us with Whole Foods at the beginning, because we weren't on the planogram. As much as we would say, please order up, you know, we're coming in for a demo, they didn't really want to have extra inventory, and they didn't necessarily know that we were going to sell a lot. So we ended up having a bunch of demos where we were out of stock. And we didn't even have like a coupon or anything. We were just like, come back and try it again. I mean, it really almost probably really pissed people off, actually.
It doesn't. And at that point, I mean, if there's nothing on the shelf for them to buy, then
just go
like
home.
The winning scenario is not possible, right?
Yeah.
When you talk to someone, they love it, they want to buy one. It's almost like you said, it almost turns into a letdown.
Yeah.
So I've had scenarios, I mean, when you've got a sampler, and you know, I've always been big on, if you're committing to a sampler that we want you to work for 4 hours and they get to the store and it's, the product's not there and it's not their fault, that they should get paid anyway.
Yeah.
So oftentimes we've had like kind of plan Bs in place for whenever that happens, especially early on in the life cycle of a store or a program where it is, maybe is a little more likely. And we would just have 2 to 3 other stores ready for them to go merchandise.
Oh.
So you can't do the demo.
That's such a good
idea. Go hit these other 2 or 3 stores.
Yeah.
There's a demo at this store in a week. Let's make sure that one's set. And you know, this seems kind of obvious, but like when you really lean into it, this kind of works too, is when you send someone to a store and there's not product there, you better make sure that you leverage that with the grocery guy and you get some sympathy out of it.
Yeah.
Because they're going to feel bad about it. And the more you make them realize that, listen, like, you don't want to get mad at them. You just want to say, hey, what can I do next time to help to make this easier? How can I make sure this? And if you really drill that, I mean, a lot of it is education. And, you know, early on with Sir Kensington's, they would have 8 to 10 bottles on the shelf. And you know, we'd come in and say, no, we need like 30 to 40 on the shelf. We're going to rip this through the shelf. And they almost like didn't believe you.
No, they didn't believe us.
And then when it happens a few times, you have to make sure to go like kind of give them like a very polite, I told you so.
Yeah.
And like, let's work together. So in the future, there's not only enough product for the demo, but enough for when I leave.
Right.
And so if you're really using that, you know, you can just throw a little bit of education and a little bit of a relationship with them. You can really kind of have those dwindle down over time.
Before we finish up, I want to hear any advice that you might have for people founding new companies, people sort of out there responsible for marketing their brands. You know, what would you say are your sort of big, you know?
I think above all else, I think people are paramount. And I've said it before, but I think just overinvest in finding good people. Sometimes they're current fans. Sometimes they're in your network. I mean, the smaller you are, oftentimes I mean, you know, with Sir Kensington's, this was a situation where I knew Mark and Scott before, and mm-hmm. we were kind of friends, if you will. But so a situation where I was there already, and like, so early on when you're thinking about hiring people, like hire passionate people,
right.
Hire people that are cultural fits. As long as they have the intangibles that you can't teach, like the hard work ethic, like the passion, like you could teach them most of this other stuff. And you know, sometimes when you have people who are a little bit light on experience, they're also light on bad habits.
Yep.
And you can form those habits and teach them how to do it your way. So I think my advice would be find good people and then keep them good by like really investing in the culture and really making sure that, you know, hitting a sales number is not the only, although hitting sales numbers are great and it cures a lot of things.
Yep.
Making sure people are happy and excited to come to work. You know, I always used to say, you know, it's not work if you're having fun. And if you could just create an environment where people are having fun and they don't feel like they're working, then like magical things happen early on. And all those people, before you know it, 5 years later, will be, half of them will be on your senior management team.
Yeah.
And they'll grow with the company. And having, when you get to be this, you know, when you get to be a larger size and you have the institutional knowledge, the cultural knowledge of someone who's been with you since the beginning and they're kind of a leading voice, I think it can be very helpful in keeping a company's mission true and staying connected to, you know, what was the genesis of this? Why did we start this? So,
totally. Do you think there's a place, I mean, is there a field guide to field marketing anywhere? Like, you know, for a lot of us, we have good people that have a lot of heart. We just don't know what's possible. You know, we don't know what's expected. We don't know how to talk to buyers in stores, or we've never, you know, I didn't know what a route ride was until, you know, like 6 months in when Doris told me that I hadn't done one and I didn't know that I was supposed to, you know, is it the kind of thing that you just need to learn from a mentor or someone who's done it before and it's just passed down knowledge kind of?
You know, I mean, I'm not sure of any,
there's a book for you to write.
Field marketing, 101 handbooks for like the natural CPG space. Right. I mean, it's something where as soon as you write the book, half of it would be out of date, just with the way things are changing. So I think it's more of a mentality. It's more of like these larger, broader concepts of like finding your consumers, creating trial and awareness, converting, hiring passionate people, having kind of a don't be afraid to fail, go big attitude, beg for forgiveness, not for permission.
Right.
Just, you know, just being aggressive.
Those are some very good tenets.
Yeah.
Those are great. What's the most fun you've had? I know you've had a lot of fun because you are a guy who just looks at life that way. But can you remember before we go, just like a win, like one particular like, this was great.
I would say the two biggest kind of campaigns where I was just like, oh man, I can't believe I'm getting paid for this. This is work. One was at Honest Tea. It was actually a campaign that stretched 5 years. It was called Honest Cities and then eventually Honest Tea Index. It was a social experiment that we just started, like when we were launching Coca-Cola in San Francisco, we just started this on the streets just to make a video, just to get the distributor excited the next day.
Right.
And it ended up turning into like this national campaign. It was just unmanned pop-up stores where we were selling Honesty for a dollar on the honor system. And there was like a big clear money box in the middle of it.
Right.
And we would hide in the background and we would keep track of who was stealing and who was paying.
Oh my gosh.
And then at the end of this, you know, this was like a few cities the first year. And then it eventually grew to the point where in-house with our field marketing team at Honesty, we didn't hire an agency for this, for the actual execution. We went to all 50 states in 10 days and did 10-hour activations in each state because it's an experiment, right?
Right.
So everything's got to be controlled.
Oh my gosh.
And then we released this like infographic, and the whole goal of this was really to get press. And
we got
pickup in 49 out of 50 states, and we spent maybe like $600,000 or $700,000 on it and got like $5-6 million worth of earned media out
That's
of it.
That's amazing. Also like genius.
It was a lot
That's
of fun.
Like experiential marketing to the, like before there was a thing called experiential marketing.
Exactly.
All right. That was one. And then the second.
And so the guy I did that with at Honesty is actually now my new boss at Good Culture.
Oh, no way.
He's Jesse Merrill, the founder of Good Culture. And it was him and I. He's the one that hired me as an intern at Honesty back
that
in the day.
That is so cool.
So this Good Culture, it's a little bit of a reunion of sorts, which is awesome. The second one real quick was with Sir Kensington's.
Yeah.
You know, selling condiments. You got to find something for the condiments to go on.
Right.
Got to find a way to be impactful, to be loud, to get it to events and retailers all over the country.
Right.
So we did a food truck.
Yes.
We did
the
a
fries.
We did a fry truck, and it was awesome. I mean, we did it with this agency called Pro Mobile Kitchen, who are, I mean, if you're ever thinking about doing a food truck, you have to call these guys. They handle everything from soup to nuts. And we just went around the country. We took this thing. It was basically a billboard on wheels that was pumping out hot fries.
Totally.
We went to retailer headquarters, to actual stores. stores, to events, just guerrilla. You know, we would go to Union Square and give out 7,500 fry cones in like 6 hours.
It's amazing.
And it was insane. It was just so much fun to see fries just flowing out of the truck and and people just like loving it. You know, when you're passionate about a brand and you're like surrounded by people who are just like loving what you do, it's like, it's the biggest compliment in the world.
You're like the Beatles.
Exactly.
You're like the Yankees. All right, Mr. Yankee. Thank you for coming. So that is it for the first episode of this third season of the podcast. Thank you, Pat, so much for coming. Good luck at Good Culture. Again, like, they're lucky to have you. You're a rock star. I'm so excited for the incredible guests that are coming on in future weeks. We have a representative from UNFI coming. We have John Lawson from Whole Foods coming. Becca from Becca PR, a bunch of other founders and entrepreneurs. I have my outsourced CFO coming to talk about good financial practices, because those are very important people. And a lot of people with a lot of experience and so much we can learn from. As always, Matt, it's so good. We're reunited, and I'm so happy about it. Thank you for being such a great engineer. And we'll see you next time on In the Sauce.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.